The sun beats down over 90,000 fans. Gentlemen, let battle commence here in Barcelona.
Away they go, a great start. Nice and expect from Dani Pedrosa, but also from Jorge Lorenzo. Not so great from Crosso, but he's finally got it hooked up. They go side by side, down to turn one. And Jorge Lorenzo, just like he did in Mugello, is going to take the lead.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 368 for Wednesday, the 19th of June, 2013. My name is Jules Cisek. I'm in the California. And with me is Martin Darlington in the Wales. And Martin has just returned from Spain, from Barcelona, where he attended the Catalunya round with his lovely wife, Sharon, and they were fans. They went as fans.
We were indeed, yeah. We went with six slabs of Welshness, of Welsh male, and no sheep at all, though. just to really please my friends. No, we had a brilliant time. It was really good. I mean, the first time Sharon and I went to Catalonia, it was 2009, and the race is not going to live up to that, but I suspect very few ever do. Mm. But it was a great experience, really enjoyed it. First time we've been since 2010. And then we stayed on for a couple of extra days. So we got to go and see Barcelona and not just the Circuit de Catalunya. And to celebrate,
nice.
I thought I'd just pop my only one of those because I'm back to work tomorrow. And we've got shit weather for the weekend, which is great. I much prefer flying in crap weather. It's a bit more challenging.
Oh. Okay.
anyone can ponce around in blue skies, can't they? When it's hot, helicopters don't like it. Yeah.
Anyone, huh?
Well, you know. Yeah, you know what I mean. Yeah. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's just, and plus, if the weather's glorious, one, you know, if someone wants to know what it's like, put a crash helmet and a boiler suit on, go and sit in someone's greenhouse on a hot sunny day. So we get overheated, the helicopter doesn't perform as well. And when it's glorious weather, you want to be at home in the garden.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
We had a beautiful day yesterday. Mira and I stood in the garden just talking crap and throwing a tennis ball at each other for about an hour and a half.
It's the best.
Sharon said she kept looking out and thinking, oh my God, they're still doing it. And we were doing like silly stunt throws and catches and gradually started throwing it harder and harder at each other. It was brilliant fun.
Brilliant. Brilliant. I love it.
So.
Right. We've got an interview from Jim. This is actually a second shot at talking with Brendan Creighton. The first time. There were some technical difficulties, so Brandon and Jim got together again this week to talk about everything, motorcycle racing, but obviously about the TT yep. As well. And so we'll have that later on. And we have a bunch of feedback and questions, but you have a bit in here about Andrew.
Yes. Well, the donators, yet again, we found ourselves apologizing, and we do sincerely apologize, guys, but Jim, I believe, is actually moving this
yes.
week, and he's slowly sorting through the recurring subscribers and the one-off donators, and we absolutely will. Basically, we're going to just have there's no racing this weekend that we're going to report on. So next week, the whole show will just be reading out the list of donators since we last did it. But some listeners may remember that Andrew Mantle, a Welsh-based listener, and myself have been indulging in little bets. And we alternate whoever loses chucks a fiver either at Motopod, and then the next week or the next race, it's Wales or Ambulance. And it was Motopod's turn, and Andrew said, let's go for a double. So he picked the bet. He thought Crutchlow would beat Rossi and Marquez would beat Pedrosa. And I thought, well, I'd quite like both of his bets to come off, but, you know, from a patriotic and I want someone to take points off Danny point of view. But I thought, yeah, I'll take that. And of course, I ended up winning £10 on behalf of Motopod. So Andrew has donated it already. So thank you very much indeed, Andrew. And I look forward to the next one. We're going to come up with a decent bet for Assen.
Nice.
I'm hoping he's going to back Pedrosa to beat Lorenzo, because Lorenzo wins there quite regularly and Danny hasn't won there in 11 years, apparently.
Yeah.
So I was reading earlier.
Cool.
But moving on.
Yeah.
listener feedback. We had an email from John Kelly, and I'll just read out bits of John's email because he goes in quite a bit of depth about racing stuff as well. But one thing he did say, he was just listening to the second from last podcast, and at about the 1 hour 24 minute mark, Martin dropped the Jesus insult. I'm not singling out because you all do it on occasion. I'm okay with F-bombs and the like because in the appropriate spot they add colour to the commentary. I'd agree with John's comment about that. He said, but I cringe when the Jesus bomb goes off. I'm probably in the minority, but in these PC days when you can't seem to be able to offend anyone, Christians are still easy beats. I'll even make you a deal. You can use it as many times as you take Mohammed in vain. I didn't think so. Well, I will interject there. That's a slightly unfair comparison, John, because we've both been brought up in Christian environments. So saying, you know, Jesus is something that we would naturally do, whereas Mohammed's not really a name that springs to mind. He said, so whilst I won't stop listening if you disregard me, but would appreciate if you hold off on it. And then he goes on to some, someone apparently christened Ben Spees Lord Spees's Christ at the time he's coming to MotoGP. and John says, reckons that's bad karma. That's as bad a karma as one could foist upon Steez, and lo and behold, he's fallen from grace in the meantime. So Ben should get hold of that guy and sue him or something. I did reply to John by email and suggested that was tongue-in-cheek, which he agreed with. So, but yeah.
Well, the only thing I wanted to say here is just that, and it's just something that we've been saying for a while now, is the show has evolved over the years from commentary from the outside to kind of we have a lot more contact with the actual people we talk about here, and Jim does all the interviews, and well, we all do interviews, but Jim especially. And I think the show has evolved into, this is what it sounds like on the inside of the sport, you know, this is what the conversations actually sound like in the paddock, you know. And I think some people would be very shocked at how
profanity.
The profanity for example, I consider myself a bit of a feminist, and so I'm constantly offended, quote unquote, by the kind of stuff that is said about women in the paddock, But, you know, I grew a thick skin over the years, and it doesn't bother me as much anymore. I think the lifestyle that is led, here in these guys who, especially people like Mark Miller, who literally, I should say the way he says it, are putting their life on the line every time they're out there. It tends to, I think, drift into a territory where kind of anything goes when they're off. You know what I mean?
I mean, having
really cringe at some of the things that are said in there, and we don't get
sacred.
This bad. We don't get that bad.
Nothing's sacred, and nothing's beyond the pale, and nothing is, you know, beyond the limits. Now, I used to think of that sort of humor and that banter as squaddy humor, army humor, because that's the environment in which I first experienced it. And I find it's a great release valve. It's a way of testing your colleagues as well. You know, if you can't push them to the point they get annoyed with you, then they're probably going to be pretty solid support when you need them. But since I've left the army and I've worked in an environment with paramedics and pilots, it's very much the same. I suspect it's when you get primarily men working in an environment which has an element of risk, I think it's that, or where you see the results of other people's, you know, misplaced risks, then I think it's just one of those things that nothing goes beyond limits. And I also think it makes people question the existence of a almighty being that has any kind of control.
Well, I don't know about that. There's plenty of. In fact, one of the things that always strikes me is the God, you know, I'm a failed Catholic. What do you call it exactly when you cross yourself? What's that?
Genuflection.
Genuflection.
I think, isn't it?
I don't know, man. But on the grid just before the start of the race, it's amazing. And I mean, you know, you look at almost all the racers, they, you know, from Sete Gibber now to the young guys these days, they do actually mention, you know, and thank you to the guy upstairs or whatever, or they at least make some kind of acknowledgement. One of the things that really I thought was really kind of very telling of the kind of attitude these guys have when they go out on the grid and they're about to start the race was the way Salom, when he was at COTA,
yeah,
and the mechanics were leaving the grid, he was hugging all of them as they were leaving. And it was very heartfelt. Like, you could tell that he really, they're a very close-knit family. And it's almost like a, hey, you know, just in case we don't see each other or something, you know, maybe I'm reading way too much into it, but there's so much emotion there. There was so much emotion there. I even have some photos. I should really get those photos up on Flickr, and because there's a couple of photos of there where you could really see the emotion, you know.
Which it's like the wife who every morning when the husband goes to work makes sure the last word she says is "I love you," just in case something happens to one or the other of them.
Yep.
You know, I mean, Sharon says it to me every morning, but that's probably because she knows I'm not a very good pilot. So I kind of get it. So I think to sum up with John, I'm sorry if I've offended anybody, but at the same time, I have to be realistic and acknowledge that I'll probably do it again.
Yeah.
I said to him in the email, I can't guarantee I won't do it because it's so embedded into my vocabulary. I almost certainly will, but occasionally I might inwardly wince as I remember his email.
Right.
So that's probably as good as I can go.
Fair enough.
I think we appreciated the call.
Yeah, totally. Okay.
Heath Richter, something I noticed this year is that Pedrosa seems to have lost his lightning starts. Do you have any theories in why the best starter in MotoGP seems to have lost his starting pep? I suspect it's not that he's lost it.
It's that the other ones have picked it up.
Lorenzo in particular he's practiced starts a lot, but let's not also forget, since the 1000 came in, he's got an extended wheelbase. His bike is longer than Ross's.
Yep.
His and Cal, and I believe Bradley, they're using a slightly longer. Now, I think we're probably talking millimetres here, but that is going to help reduce the amount of wheelie control that's required, which obviously controls by slowing the bike down. So I don't think Danny's got slower, and maybe, I don't know, but maybe the Honda's slightly shorter and therefore he's got a bit of a wheelie control issue, which keeps kicking in and slowing him down. So, which brings us back to Josh Hayes's comment from last year of, you know, traction control, wheelie control, if you've got it dialed right up, you ain't going to win because you'll be going really slowly.
right. I do think that when you watch this year, if you watch the starts, there was only one race, I don't remember, I think it was maybe Le Mans, where Pedrosa actually seemed to have missed his usual awesome lightning start. But in the other cases, it's been the fact that Lorenzo just beats him on those starts.
But he does seem to get it. I mean, at Catalonia, from what we could see, we were at the final above the final turn, so we were looking onto the start-finish straight, so we couldn't get any perspective at the far end, but we had a good jumbotron just opposite us. And it looked like he did get the lightning start, but by the time they got to the first corner, Lorenzo was... it's almost like Danny's first gear's quicker, but Jorge's second gear's quicker.
Ah, nice.
So by the time they got to the corner, he had a little bit more momentum. And, of course, I remember Cal Crutchlow saying last year, when someone said to him, do you get to see Jorge's data? He said, yeah, sometimes I wish I hadn't. and he said he breaks earlier than most of the other top riders, but he breaks less, and he lets the brakes off much earlier than them and then carries this amazing corner speed. So I think that's how he gets past, if it's at a first corner that is possible. And, of course, this year it was.
Yeah.
So hopefully, Heath, we've
helped
give you some food for thought there, yeah. Now, you're going to have to do this next one because you've got the accent.
What? Oh, I have to do a big John Hart accent? I can't quite do I can't quite do that accent, but I guess for you, I have an accent, because
deep south?
I'm an American. We all have the same accent, as far as you're concerned.
Absolutely not. I know the difference between New Jersey. And New Jersey, the toiki with the moist. Yeah. And, oh, terrible news about James Gandolfini.
Oh, yeah.
That's awful. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. So, yeah, props to Tony Soprano. Yeah, so, and then your ding, 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 ding type Deep South stuff. And I'd imagine Big John Hart's going to have a really deep, he's going to be the American Neil Spaulding, isn't he? Renzo's ass cold, Mr. Consistent.
Exactly.
Marquez may not be the next Agostini.
Keep going.
Valentino's over the hill. Pedroza's the best second place rider in MotoGP. Nicky and Spies to World Superbike in 2014.
Dude, that was better than I could have ever done. Fantastic.
That is all. Yeah. Oh, thank you very much.
All right, That
was Big John's.
I loved it. I loved it. Five bullet points. It's fantastic. And I just want to address.
Who was it?
I just want to address the Pedroza one.
Yeah.
Because he has won two races this year, and he's leading the championship. So Pedroza is the second.
And he has. And he has started. Do you remember Jerez last year when Lorenzo tracked, you know, ripped down 2 seconds in a lap or something to catch him up, got past him, and I thought, oh, Danny's just been psychologically destroyed again, and then he came straight back.
Yeah.
And now, okay, Lorenzo got past him again and won, but I did think, oh, he's shown a bit of fight. Now, again, obviously, he actually didn't have a great year at the beginning of last year, but towards the end of last year, he can duke it out, as you guys would say, you know, far more than he ever used to. So, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, after the first two races this year, you know, he's fourth in Qatar, and then he's beaten by Marquez and Kocher, and I was confidently saying, well, that's it. Danny's finished. He's psychologically destroyed. He's going to become an emotional wreck. And remember all that crack about, you know, he'll know it's over when he catches Alberto Puig leaving Marquez's motorhome with a freshly signed contract in his hand. Yeah, that kind of hasn't happened.
No.
I really don't know what I'm talking about. So he's looking strong.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. As far as Nicky and Spies of Superbikes, you know what? We'll probably be talking about that later in the year.
And let's not forget, Spies has actually got a 2-year contract. He's contracted to Pramac Ducati for next year.
Yes, he is. He is.
Nicky's not. And that is a possibility. But he's God, I mean, he's not exactly miles away.
No.
On a bike that everyone's struggling on.
If he didn't have the issue that everybody else had at Catalunya, he could have had a very, very strong finish.
Yeah.
You know?
And he looked really, really angry.
Oh, I know. I know.
Pissed. He was punching hell out of that air barrier.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not often you see Nicky Hayden demonstrative.
The last time he was that demonstrative was at
2006.
Yeah. At Estoril.
Was it Estoril? Yeah.
When Danny pushed him off. All right. And then we have a really excellent email from Nick Codling. I basically separated this into three sections. The first one is, I've just finished yawning from watching yesterday's MotoGP race. It's a shame that the conditions seem to catch out so many. Nicky Hayden was on for a great result, and I wanted to see Cal help cement his ever-strengthening reputation as a solid finisher. He's not jumped off it for a while, and as it seems to be the case now, this championship is going to be decided by consistency and lack of mistakes. Very true. Or it could be, were it not for the fact that Yamaha are apparently burning through their engines and might be on their final one soon. Could this mean that we end up with an almost unbelievable position of Lorenzo potentially losing the championship because he's penalized for using up his allocation? You have to hand it to Honda, apparently suggesting they would support a drop to 2 engines per year, but would supportingly allow 3 so that everyone else can play. Now, before we go on with the other points that Nick made, I do want to point out that the fact that Yamaha is uncrating the engines, does that necessarily mean that they are used
expired.
Up? They are expired. No. In fact, it's a kind of an interesting strategy because you get to kind of run your engine in right away and see if there's any issues with it, right? As opposed to leaving it, and then let's say that the championship moves on and it's really tight and you're running towards the end and you have to take a new engine and it turns out the engine is shit, you know.
Yeah. And they have Massimo Maragalli. One of the team managers had said both Rossi and Lorenzo had found a problem with one of the early opened engines, so they've set that to one side. They've opened four of their five, and he said, "But we fully expect to get to the end of the season with five engines still." You know, he said, "Crashes apart if we have an Aston last year where Lorenzo chewed one up." I mean, David Emmett wrote a fascinating piece saying that how Lorenzo's mental strength, part of it comes from the team playing to his strengths and weaknesses. Last year, he was adamant that because Bautista wiped him out and that chewed his engine, he'd be given an extra one. And they kind of encouraged him in that thought, knowing that there's absolutely no chance that's going to happen. So then when he's told, no, you can't have it, they're like, okay, we'll deal with that. That's fine. But they're two or three races further down the line because they were appealing and all that. And there was suggestion.
Oh, so by that time he's calmed down, basically.
But he's calmed down, and they've got three other races out of the way when he hasn't been worrying about it.
Right.
And he's made up those lost points, and he's still out in the lead. So,
nice.
You know, very cleverly played. There is a valid point, though, about Honda. In 2011, Casey won and only used two engines.
Yeah.
All season. So Honda probably do think they can run a season. But I don't want to see the championship decided by. You know, it was a cost-cutting measure. That's fine, but let's not make it who can produce the most reliable engine, because that's going to come down to material and that's going to come down to money. And Honda's got the biggest budget, so they're going to win.
Well, it's not just that. You know, we've got other manufacturers here, and there's only two that can really afford to do that kind of R&D. You know.
Yeah.
And
the Yamaha, and they're the two that we've been seeing at the front.
Exactly. Exactly. So. You know, here's Suzuki. We're going to talk about that in a sec. You know, starting to their return. The last thing we want is for them to be, you know, oh, and by the way, you only get two engines for the entire season.
Yeah.
So all your research now that you've been doing on just getting the electronics package back in there. Oh, also you have to have a reliability way up on an engine that's not untested over a season. So yeah. Let's move on with his email. And in the meantime, we have an extremely mature Danny trying to get on with being consistent, and Marquez playing at being the excitable puppy with a new toy. I like that. You have to say right now Honda is looking very, very strong, and I suspect that will only become more so as the year progresses. And, you know, I just like the Marquez playing at being the excitable puppy. I think what we're seeing really is Marquez just testing the boundaries of the bike.
And I mean, did you read his comments about the Catalunya race? And he said, you know, I was absolutely 100% pushing and pushing and pushing, and I knew I might crash, but I thought, well, you know, it's my first year. No one's going to be too angry with me, but I need to keep up because I learned so much watching Danny and Jorge that I needed to stay with them as long as I could.
Mm.
And you think, bloody hell. And you know, after, and again, this is one of my, you know, insights that actually will probably turn out to be a complete load of hoopla, but I had a feeling that after Mugello, listening to some of his comments, that was his crash fest. That all the very look at Stoner in 2006, Lorenzo in 2008, Danny not so much. I think Danny had quite a mature approach when he came up. He seemed to sort of, okay, he wiped out Nicky at Estoril, but you know, he didn't go nuts throwing it at the scenery. But I wonder if he's had... Yeah, I'm not saying he's not going to put it down again this season. Of course, it's inevitable that's likely to happen, particularly someone like Laguna Seca, which he's never seen.
Right.
But I just think... I think he might be a frighteningly quick learner.
No, I totally agree with you about Mugello. I think that he knew that Danny and Jorge would be strong there. And he didn't want to fall further behind, and he just really, to learn the machines, you kind of have to see where that envelope is, and sometimes that means going across it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's the old Kenny Roberts line, isn't it? If you're not crashing, you're not going fast enough.
Exactly. All right, and the final thing is from Nick's email. So Suzuki won't be entering until 2015. So at least that partially shuts down the Cal rumor, at least in that regard. Good to see them testing and seemingly so well. Bodes well, and it'll be great to see them competitive. Here's hoping. So yeah, that was a bummer because basically what it turns out is just they just, you know, I'm so used to fast turnaround and development because I'm a software engineer. So when they're talking about electronics and taking a year, an extra year, an entire season, you know, I mean, we're not even through this season. We're not even halfway through this season. And they're talking about taking yet another season next year to develop, to just match the electronics to the engine. It makes me think that there's probably more than just that that they're working on, you know. There may be some, you know, internal politics and stuff like that involved as well. I think it probably makes it a little bit safer for them. They can see what happens. They can see what kind of regulations, you know, happen, what happens to the CRTs, all sorts of interesting stuff.
Yeah, and yeah, no, I agree, but I had that same sort of reading between the lines with Nick. That's all. Oh, that's disappointing.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is because we were so really. I mean, you know, they have wild cards out this year. The test results. Do we have the exact numbers for Suzuki?
I know that today, which is actually Thursday, the 20th. Randy got within 1.5 seconds of Lorenzo's time from Wednesday, from yesterday.
Yeah,
it was only Marquez on the HRC on the, I think, the 2014 bike, or it might be the 2013.
Right,
can't remember today. And he improved his time, and Randy DiPugno improved his time. And someone says, you know, well, he's still a second and a half off. I'm thinking, hang on a sec, Lorenzo broke Stoner's pole record, fastest ever lap round there, on a circuit that Lorenzo supposedly always struggled with setup. So he's really happy, you know. Well, Randy's probably a good third to half that time, you know. He's half to three quarters of a second slower, even if he's on the same bike as Lorenzo anyway, because he's a great rider, Randy DiPugno, but he ain't no Lorenzo. And it's a brand new bike that the engineers will still be learning, he's still learning, at a track they're not running. You know, I actually think 1.5 seconds is pretty reasonable, but it does bring us back to the oft quoted by us Colin Edwards thing of, no, that the first second of that 1.5, that's easy.
Exactly.
That's easy to make up.
You might get that. You know?
Yeah. The last half second, that's the cast iron son of a bitch. Yep. Yep. So, yeah, that's...
But taking an entire year to get used to the Magneti Morelli's, you know, electronics.
That seems strange.
It does seem like but, you know, like I was saying, I think there's a safety net that they have to put in place in order to receive funds, maybe from the top brass at Suzuki. You know,
that they were always probably I always got the feeling they had the tightest purse strings.
Yes.
Of all the big four, when you had Kawasaki and Suzuki and the five, including Ducati, but certainly the big four Japanese. It was Suzuki always seemed to be the ones going, do you really need that extra set of tires? Yeah, we can't get through a whole weekend with one.
Let me get back to you on that.
You know, yeah. we'll have a look at the budget. Right. So
True. It's true. But yeah, but that's now been decided. So there's no Suzuki in 2014, which means Cal, I don't know. I could see him taking Nicky's seat if Nicky doesn't get a contract back. We'll see what happens.
Let's not forget, I mean, Cal supposedly did tell the Bernhard Gobmeier to get the fuck out of his motorhome.
Yeah.
After he believed he had a deal in place.
Yep.
And then when he spoke to Hervé and spoke to Lucy and his, you know, team and everyone else he needed to speak to, you know, went back and said, yeah, let's meet. And they went there and said, oh, sorry, we've signed Dovi. But let's face it, I think with how well he's been doing, and I don't think him and Dovi were mates, but I don't think they didn't get on. I think, you know, they could have quite a productive relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I don't know if that's a good thing or not in a team. It seems some of the best teams seem to be the ones we ride as they hate each other's guts.
or at least feel threatened.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So, yeah, it'll be interesting.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think those kinds of bridges don't get, they're set on fire and put up fairly quickly. they don't burn to the ground.
No.
And, you know, I mean, did you ask him? I heard, didn't you fly with him on the way back?
Yeah, I was going to mention later on, but yeah, as Sharon and I came back on Tuesday, having stayed our extra couple of evenings in Barcelona, we were at the airport, and Callan, it was funny because Sharon said, you know, I said, well, wouldn't be surprised there's been tests on if we saw a couple of, you know, team
people,
you know, team members or riders coming through.
Yeah.
She went, the riders aren't going to come through here. We're going on easy jets, like, you know, budget airline. And she said, they'll get private jets now, won't they? I said, some of them will.
Right.
So Valentino Rossi probably does. Yep. I said, no, but I said, yeah, these guys aren't on footballer wages, which is ironic because Cal could have been a professional footballer.
Right. Right.
But he, you know, I think he said, I love playing football, but my passion's still bikes. So anyway, within 2 or 3 minutes of talking about this, Sharon went, oh my God, it's Cal Crutchlow. Oh, isn't he cute? Oh, isn't he little? And they came and sat. Well, we were all going through to the sort of right gate, sat down, and you know, you think, I don't want to mither him, I don't want to bother the poor fellow.
But on the other hand, but, you know, you gotta say something.
Yeah, so we just said, you know, guides, you know, for what happened on Sunday. And if anyone doesn't know, that's a spoiler, but we're about to tell you anyway. Unfortunately, Cal crashed out, and he was so affable, open, happy to chat. Him and Lucy were just, you know, seem really relaxed, chilled out. I mean, I can almost guarantee one phrase you will have never heard Cal Crutchlow say is, do you know who I am? He's not at all.
Right, exactly. I can't imagine it.
And yet, when I seen him at Silverstone in the post-session, you know, each rider having his own little press conference thing, he's very intense and very focused. He's funny, you know, but here he was just completely relaxed, quite happy to talk about stuff. I mean, we'll mention it later on, but Yoni Hernandez going sideways around every corner. I mean, he got the biggest cheer from our stand out of all of them, really. He was absolutely hooning it. And Cal went, oh, you know, he said every time he comes in, he goes to his team, he goes, yeah, the rear wheel keeps spinning up. And they stare at him and go, yeah, we know that's you doing that. He said, we've said to him, that is not the quickest way around the circuit. He said, he don't give a fuck. He's just having fun. He said, he's a lovely guy. Cal did say, quite emphasized, he said, he really is such a great kid. He said, he's brilliant fun. He's a lovely bloke, but he just won't stop doing that.
Mm.
He just loves it. And I thought, you know, I like that.
I know. That's really cool.
He will get a fan base just on the fact, like Gary McCoy.
Yeah.
You know, the amount of people. Now, okay, Gary McCoy kind of invented the light in the rear up and
yeah, he also won races
and all that. But and he did win races, and he was a proper challenger. Yeah. But yeah, it was good. And he, you know, I said I obviously did the Motorpod thing and said, you know, what are the chance of getting you at Silverstone? He went. He said, I've got to be honest. He said, last couple of years, I've been busier than Rossi, which is not something people can often say. But he's, you know,
he's at Silverstone, top. Yeah.
Right. In British rider.
Yeah.
He's the best we've had for so many years. You know,
well, maybe Scott can help with that. Scott Redding maybe can help with that.
Take some of the British journalists away. Yeah. No, absolutely. Hey, don't. But the other, as I was talking to him, I went, oh, yeah. And of course, it's September. I said, so silly season be over and everyone will want to be talking to you. And he just raised his eyebrows and went, yeah, it may not be over by then. And I thought, okay. I said, well, I'm not going to, yeah, I won't ask you any more about that. And Sharon said to me, she went, it's all right. He's not a proper journalist. Which I just thought was brilliant. I was like, thanks. So she got a photo with him. He was such a nice guy, you know, really, really. They hadn't been home for 2 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just thought, you know, that. Okay, of course, it's not a tough life in the sense of worrying about putting food on your table for your children to eat in that sense, but it's got to be quite challenging, you know, and they seem really happy. And I thought it was really nice. And we also met Duncan Bishop in an Irish bar in Barcelona. We'd only gone in just to sort of because we need to use a toilet. We thought, do we want a cafe? You know, oh, let's go and have a beer. It's lunchtime. So we went in this Irish bar, lovely staff, really nice. Had a pint of Guinness, got a tweet from Dungan saying, I'm on my lunch hour, where are you? I said, O'Hara's Irish bar, just off the Rambler. He went, right, I'll be there. So Dungan turned up. 3 pints later, we were like, he went, shit, I better go back to work. he's ridiculously young.
What does that mean, like three?
No. I mean, I know he's in his 20s, but he honestly, he could pass for a teenage student, a 19-year-old gap year student who's, you know, bumming around Barcelona, you know, before he goes off to uni.
Nice.
But no, really very well connected, very knowledgeable. And it reminded me of when we've talked before about I'm blessing Peter Lenz or Bradley Smith, you know, these young kids who look like a little schoolboy.
Mm. Yeah.
And yet the words they use, right, those of an experienced racer would Duncan's exactly the same. You look at it, you think, you could probably be my son biologically. In fact, quite easily. Good God. And yet, you know, he talks the way Matthew Burt or Julian Ryder would talk, you know, not in the same accent, but, you know, so yeah, that was good.
Very cool. Very cool. This one we may struggle through a little bit because there's some tech involved, but Sam Dixon writes in, could you guys do a bit of a tech segment on understeer and other issues with bike rideability in MotoGP? I hear the term understeer constantly regarding the Ducati and its problems getting around certain corners and circuits. I have a vague idea of what that means, but I'd love to hear an in-depth explanation if possible. So, very basically speaking, the understeer, both in motorcycles and cars, is when you're...
You turn the wheel right, well, but the car goes straight on.
Well, that's very basic, yes. But basically, the front is being pushed to the corner, yeah, instead of being the pulling the bike through the corner.
If you imagine you're coming into that first turn in Catalunya and you want to turn right almost 90 degrees, mm-hmm, without getting into semantics, I think understeer and oversteer, think about the front of the car. So with understeer, the front pushes on off the track. It wants to go straight on rather than turn right. So it's not steering enough. So it's understeering. Whereas oversteer, even though what's actually generally happens is it's the back that lets go and swings round. So you've gone too far. You wanted to turn 90 degrees and you've gone through 120 degrees. Hence, oversteer, I think, is probably the easiest way. Of course, with a bike, if you oversteer, you tend to very shortly afterwards high side.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Exactly. I was just going to say. Plus, you know, so the thing is, the physics involved in this are so complicated that, like, it's very difficult to describe. I mean, there's still riders out there that don't even believe, racers that still, well, not, I wouldn't say believe, but still don't exactly understand counter steering. You know, it's just all natural, yeah, right? Because
you can demonstrate.
Oh, I know, of course, it's been demonstrated, it's been proven, but I'm just saying that the kind of physics that affect a bike turning are so complex. And this is the art of suspension, you know, yeah, of getting that, getting that. I mean, because the other thing is, when you go into a corner, you're loading up the front because that's why you're hitting the brakes, which means that the contact batch grows in the front and lightens in the back, gets smaller in the back. I mean, in most cases with the MotoGP bikes, when they have to brake really hard, there is no contact patch in the back. Yeah. But it
might be worth mentioning that counter steering is, if you want to, coming back to our example of the first corner at Catalunya, which is, you know, a fairly steep right hander, you actually, to initiate the lean, which will take you around that corner, you actually steer to the left. So you push the right hand handlebar, so the wheel turns slightly left and the bike starts to fall to the right. And what takes you around the corner is, well, gravity and inertia, and what keeps you from completely falling over.
Well, it's
gyroscopic.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at what happens to the wheels as when you do push that bar away, the geometry of the whole bike changes, and that's, yeah. I mean, my brother is a scientist at the University of Montreal, and I remember when
That's in Canada, isn't it?
Yes. It's a little country inside of Canada.
That's the one.
But he when I first started riding motorcycles, I remember he was always like a had a research kind of mind, and I showed him counter steering. He did not believe it, and he had to go. He went and just read up on it, and like, you know, this was years and years, decades ago. So there wasn't that much. There wasn't a Keith Code bike to prove it yet, but he came up with some pretty interesting stuff. Some interesting theories that were mostly wrong, but you know.
And I mean, I think it's worth remembering as well that suspension enables you to do it much faster. But even on a bicycle, anyone who's ever ridden a bicycle going around the corner, which I guess is everyone who's ever ridden a bicycle, you know, with no suspension whatsoever, you're still counter steering. Mm-hmm. And you're still experiencing the same forces, just at a much more sedate pace.
Yeah. Yeah.
So hopefully, Sam, that gives you a bit of insight.
So there's the specific issue with the Ducati, which has been there from the beginning, because it explains the crashes that Stoner had, was that the bike never loads up the front tire correctly. And so you don't get as much of enough grip there,
and feel.
And because you don't have enough grip, you don't get the right feel back to the controls, through the controls. So basically, you know, when riders talk about the front end feel, they're really talking about the feedback that they get through the handlebars, or, you know, all the way up the suspension. If the suspension is too soft, or it's not the softness really. It's just if it's taking a lot of that feedback away because of the way it's built, designed, set up for that particular track, if it doesn't match what the rider kind of wants to get back from the front end feel, the confidence level drops in the rider, which is what Rossi was complaining about for 2 years, you know.
Mm.
And
Stoner before him.
And Stoner before him. Except that Stoner rode it anyway, and then, you know, would constantly crash when it did give away.
And he said but it would happen without warning. He said, you know, you're used to, in a race, three or four times or more, you know, that you'll be saving it on your knee.
Yeah.
But you can feel it coming. Right. So you're like, brace. Yeah, okay, that is the limit. That's the limit. And then he said, you know, you do a lap, think, okay, I wasn't quite the limit, go a bit quicker. Yeah, no, that's good. Next lap, yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's fast enough, you know, winning at the slowest speed and all that. And then the next lap, doing exactly the same thing in exactly the same place at exactly the same speed, and it would just go. And it would go so quickly, he said, you've just got no chance to save it at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
And supposedly Ducati's answer was, you keep winning, what are you whinging about?
Yeah, back then.
It's like, oh, okay.
And you know, so, yeah. a lot of the manufacturers of prototypes, especially, are very keenly aware of the fact of that the where the engine sits exactly, and the length of the engine, everything is really designed to make that transition from power to braking as smooth and with as much feedback for the rider, you know, so that when you go from, you know, being on the power and hitting the brakes, the entire time that you're braking, you know how much grip you have left. And this is what Rossi has been complaining on the Ducati and on the Yamaha this year, although he, at the test, I should mention that he was very, very happy. He said they stole some of the settings from Jorge in the rear, which stiffened it up, and he really liked that. But the thing that he really is happy about, Rossi, is that they found something with the front where he finally can brake at Rossi braking kind of.
Well, one of the problems they've been having apparently is with full fuel tanks, and both Rossi and Cal Crutchlow have been complaining about this. Now, the two factory riders, Lorenzo and Rossi, have been given a new fuel tank which stores the fuel lower. And that apparently is one of the breakthroughs that's made a big difference. And Rossi said, look, before that, Lorenzo could go fast out the blocks. I couldn't. I just couldn't keep up. And that was borne out under Catalunya. He very, very slowly dropped back in the early laps, then was matching their pace, and in the latter laps was even starting to close a little bit. But it was too late. He was 5 seconds behind them all. So yeah. He couldn't close the gap to the leading three.
Yeah. Yep.
And that's what they needed. It's that speed from the off. And Cal said pretty much the same, that he struggles to be on the limit right at the start of the race when all that extra weight of the fuel's in there.
Right.
So, right.
Well, let's get to the results. I mean, let's talk about the races and then run with the interview and wrap this up.
Okay, look, I was just going to say before that, it's worth mentioning Randy Mamola doing the two-seater.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Prosto Ducati, the two-seater MotoGP bike after, I think it was Matt Oxley, or it might have been Matt Burt, tweeted that they reckon he's done 2,200 safe laps. He did finally crash, and it was weird. We didn't see it. We heard he'd looped it, which I thought, well, don't tell me he's done a wheelie and flipped over the back, but it wasn't that at all. They came round turn 10, which is the one with the big red Circuit de Catalunya on the inside.
Crashed. This weekend.
Where everyone crashed going into the corner, mm-hmm. but he got round the corner, was coming out of it, and the only scratchy bit of YouTube video I've seen actually is looking at, it's not Alex Crivier, who's ridden it before there. I can't remember who was on the second one. But Bettini.
Yeah.
Bettini was on the following one, so they're concentrating on him, and then you hear this woo, and they look forward, and they're on the deck, so they kind of fell over as they came out of the corner. Mm. So the only thing I think is maybe the passenger didn't sit up. Passion's got a broken wrist, which he'll probably treasure forever.
I was just going to say, the best...
I'll have a T-shirt saying, Randy Mamola broke my wrist.
Exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, I'm sure it won't make any difference the amount of people who are, you know, paying their riders for health checks to go.
Yeah.
Right, we need to get on with some results.
Yes.
Moto3, Luis Salom's weekend, pole position, Alex Rins and Miguel Oliveira made up the front row. Alex Marquez, Maverick Vinales and Efren Vasquez were the second row. Isaac Vinales, Jack Miller and Nicolo Antonelli were the third, which we'll probably do. Oh, no, worthy of mention, Livio Loy, Mark VDS's little Belgian lad, qualified 13th. Yeah. I think it's his best yet.
Getting on.
The race, and again, give the fans' point of view, you just saw them coming right round in a slightly different order every lap. It was... We had this group of five at the front who pretty much stayed together for most of the race. Mm-hmm. And then Luis Salom did what he started to do recently. 5-6 laps from the end, got to the front and made a little bit of a break. Rins and Vinales were able to close down on him to a degree, but couldn't get past him. What I noticed was, back to one of our ongoing sagas, the mysterious demise of Romano Fenati, not demise, but disappearance from the point scorers. There was a second group of seven or eight riders following that leading group, some distance behind, and he kept working his way to the front of them, which was about eighth place, then dropping back. And then he'd work his way back up. In fact, he was up to fourth at one point. He dropped back, then he gets up to eighth place, drops way back, mm-hmm. gets back up to eighth place, and ends up 15th. Don't know what was good. I don't know if you saw what was happening with him. Like, they probably weren't showing on telly either.
They weren't.
No.
They were really, because, I mean, the battle up front was pretty, you know, it's that the order didn't change for the last six laps, but it was intriguing, definitely.
Yeah.
It was a very, very good race, fine race.
So we had Salom, Rins, and Vinales. Salom was extremely happy.
Yep.
Rins was very philosophical about it. Then we had Marquez, Vasquez, Oliveira, 4th, 5th, and 6th. Jack Miller, 7th. Alex Masbu, 8th. Sulfami Kairad in 9th. Arthur Sissis, 10th. Isaac Vinales, 11th. Brad Binder, friend of the show, 12th. Alan Tetcher, 13th. Danny Webb, another friend of the show, 14th. And Romano Fenati, 15th. And it was the biggest cheer as people came around was mainly for Kevin Hannes, I believe, is a wildcard rider, and he was a long way behind, but he was on a beautiful white bike and he got a big cheer. Nice. Every time he came around. Livio Loy, we mentioned earlier, unfortunately crashed out. Jakob Kornfeil, Nicolò Antonelli, Tony Finsterbusch, Wiggy Sand down a beer, Nicholas Ayo and Jasper Iwema were the other DNFers. And the first, those three didn't even finish the first lap.
They had a little wrap-up there together, most of them.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've got the championship. Salom leads 127. Vignal is just 5 points behind at 122. Alex Rins is a further 21 points behind 101. Then there's his massive 4-point gap to Jonas Folger. And then further back, Alex Marquez.
It's 37, but 38, but yeah.
Sorry.
I mean, this is the first time Lewis Salom has actually led the championship this year, so that win changes everything.
He was completely over the moon.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was good. Moto 2 was very much seen as, you know, after the comments at Mugello, Paul Espargaro didn't say that much derogatory about his rivals for the championship. and good for him. He just let his riding do the talking. But each session we watched, he would be dominating. Scott Redding would be, you know, 7th, 8th, 9th, and then would pull something out of the hat right towards the end of the session. And so it was in qualifying. So Paul Espargaro was on pole. We had Scott Redding and Esteve Rabat, Espargaro's sparring partners, making up the front row. Takaki Nakagami, surprisingly slow for him in QP. Mm-hmm. He's been front row most of the time. Was 4th. Alex De Angelis 5th. Johann Zarco 6th. Jordi Torres, Randy Krumanak, and Sandro Cortese 7th, 8th, 9th. Tom Luthi still recovering from those injuries. 10th, Mathieu Bissino, 11th, and Mika Kallio, 12th, so on and so forth, backwards.
Well, so it's important to note that Tyrrell was in 20th.
Row 7. Yeah, 20th position.
Yeah, row 7. Not a good... I forget what happened to him. Did he crash early on and then they had to put the bike together?
In QP?
Yeah.
Yeah, he did go down at one stage. I think it was quite early.
Yeah.
And they rebuilt it and he got out again, but clearly not either the bike wasn't 100%, because let's not forget they got a one bike
in the Moto
2. So it needed some pretty rapid fixing. So yeah, he qualified in 20th and just finished just outside the points. Yep. But the race itself, Paul led from the off with Esteve Rabat behind him, Scott Redding very quickly up to 3rd, and which he held for 5 laps, and then Tom Luthi came through and took 3rd off.
Kind of
and
stealthily then, kind of made him his way up there, you know?
And Scott was dropping off, and Nakagami was slowly catching him, because you see that wasn't going to, you know, really be a... he was very unlikely he was going to catch him. Randy Krumanak had a great run coming in 6th. Now, Paul held it, and then Esteve Rabat got past him during lap 13, and looked like he was going to pull away. And then I don't know if he had a moment. We didn't see it on the big screen. They may have been showing what was going on behind. I don't know. But it was on the other side of the circuit to us. And then he came around and Pollard closed right up, got back past him. And the sequence remained the same. So Espargaro on.
It was a knife fight. It was great. Great.
No, and they were. Yeah, and they're very, very similar-looking bikes. You got a green helmet and an orange helmet. It was just like, I'm sure he just got past it. No, he didn't, you know. And they were getting huge cheers every time they came past. But Scott looked, I don't know. I don't know if you can say someone looks like they're riding in a relaxed way. He just seemed, he went into it, right, if I try and catch him, I'm going to crash. You know, we know that, you know, he's more susceptible to reducing tire wear, if only because of his weight. You know, it's not like he shreds them or anything. He rode a really conservative race and picked up, you know, 13 points, which would have been none if he hadn't. So Paul won, really happy to do that. Esteve Rabat came in 2nd by 0.081. He tried out dragging him to the line, but that finishing line is quite early in that straight.
Yes.
So even though the straight's a kilometre, I think it's only about 300 metres to the finish line. Tom Luthi, an ecstatic 3rd. Brilliant to see that. Nice kid. Scott Redding was 4th. Nakagami was 5th. Krumanak was 6th. Zarco was 7th. He had some entertaining dust-ups as well. Agata, Kallio, and Corsi and Pessini were kicking shit out of each other the entire race. They all finished within 0.6 of a second of each other. Yeah. Mike Demelio was 12th. Danny Kent was 13th. Cracking result in the Mistral. Unfortunately, Louis Rossi crashed out. And
Axel Pons
is back to 50% DNFs because he managed to finish the 34th time in his 68 races in all classes. And I'm not taking the mickey. I just, you know, bless him. I just don't want to see the kid getting hurt. And Julian Simon picked up the last point. Nick Etterall just outside with Carl Smith and so on and so forth. I've got to say, Yuki Takahashi's bike, silver with the red bits, absolutely stunning, that Moriwaki. Just doesn't go very quickly.
Right. Yeah.
We lost Willerott, West, Torres, Schrotter, Susipto, Cortese, which was just pulled into the pit, something wrong with the bike. Mm-hmm. De Angelis, Simeon, Elias, Louis Rossi, and Stephen Odendahl. And Tony Lewis didn't look very happy. He pulled into the pits as well, I think. No, he crashed, remounted, came round.
Yeah. The thing with Cortese was that he was fighting with the bike right from the very beginning. There was something wrong. Because I remember that, I don't know if you guys saw it, but there was a couple of shots of him. And he was almost at the back at one point.
Yeah, I still expect pretty good things from Sanjay Cortese.
Me too, absolutely.
And it's early days.
Yeah.
So in the championship, Scott Redding is still in the lead by 35 points now from Pol Espargaró, who's moved in second place ahead of Esteve Rabat, Mika Kallio, and Dominic Agata. And the Couture, I mean, it's all reasonably close. You've got Espargaró 79, Rabat 75, Kallio's 10 points behind them on 65, Agata 61, Tirol's 58, Zarco 53. Nakagami, surprisingly though, on 40 because he's had a couple of DNFs.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Except for the guy at the front.
Except for the guy at the front, yeah. Yeah. Who's still showing.
Almost, I mean, he's 35 points still ahead of Paul.
Yeah.
That's a big.
And we're going to Assen next, and I don't know why the Brits just seem to do quite well at
Assen. They do, but remember Paul here.
Oh yeah, that's
over
true.
Over the years, has been absolutely outstanding.
Yeah,
it's going to be a really fun race. I have a feeling.
Was it Paul who was accused of dinking Ayama going into that last? Am I thinking Simoncelli? I can't remember now.
Oh, wow.
When I was at Assen in 09.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that? There was that.
It was not Paul.
It was Bautista.
Because Paul was still 125s.
Of course he was. Yeah. In fact, that was weird. Talking about the Danny not doing well there, that was the year that him and Dovi were the HRC team.
Right.
And they each went down in about two laps apart in exactly the same place. I mean,
yep.
The scratch marks on the bikes were like 2 feet apart.
Right.
It was really weird.
Yep.
Like someone had a remote control, wash the front out button.
Yeah.
Right. So moving on to MotoGP. And I'm sorry, people, if it sounds like we're rushing through, but I've got to go to bed because I'm working tomorrow and Jules has got a work-related thing he's got to do fairly soon.
Yep.
We had, it's worth mentioning on Friday, we had Rossi topping the timesheets, which he was very happy about, but he did point out, it's only Friday.
Yeah,
and
he's been up there before on a Friday.
And we'd seen that at Mugello, exactly, and then it faded away. In Q1, we had Bradley Smith, Andrea Iannone, Alistair Spargaro had again got himself straight through to Q2.
Incredible. What a run, man.
Smith and Iannone put in a couple of cracking good laps. Bradley Smith still riding very injured. If anyone follows him on Twitter and you've seen the pictures of the skin graft on his finger, I mean, it's a mess. It's not. It's being fixed, but it looks a mess.
Yeah.
RDP, Randy Puno just missed out on getting in. Michele Pirro also. Colin Edwards qualified. What would that be? I can't remember. Wherever it works out, but very well. And so Q2 went out and we had Danny just did what he's been doing. He looks like he's struggling and then pulls an absolute ripper out. Broke the all-time, ultimate lap record, the fastest ever lap round there in 140.893. And then Cal got himself in second place.
But it's very important to point out that Pedrosa no one even got remotely close to Pedrosa. There was only one sector where I think, was it Brattle that was faster in one sector? That was like really strange.
We didn't see the sector times.
Oh, okay.
And the top six were all within a second of each other. But of that second, 60% of it was the gap between Pedrosa and Crutchlow.
Exactly.
0.608 of a second. Yeah. And then just behind Cal comes Lorenzo, then Bautista, Nicky Hayden, cracking run, Marc Marquez 6th, Rossi was 7th, Iannone 8th, Dovi was 9th, Bradle 10th, Smith 11th, and Espargaro 12th.
Yeah. I think Rossi maybe should change his number to 7 or something. He's always starting 7th these days.
Yeah. Then Danny kind of got the whole shot. He was in the lead halfway to the corner, but Jorge just did this surging thing where he just went past, bullied his way past, got out front. And I've got to be honest, it was one of those races when you were waiting for it to kick off,
and it didn't. It didn't.
No,
it didn't.
I was saying to you before the call, you know, when Sharon and I first year we went to Catalonia, it's the third time now. First time we went was 2009. Which was that race with Rossi and Lorenzo. And
you know what? I'm getting tired of hearing about that race during the Catalunya weekends because it's like...
Yeah.
It's like...
It's gone.
Everybody...
It didn't happen because it was Catalunya specifically. It happened because those two on that day, on that track, in those conditions, were so closely matched.
Right.
It was unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, can you even remember that Stoner was third and that was the race where we saw him absolutely wiped out and exhausted, and it was after that he went off and had his 3-month break to sort out the lactose intolerance? All people remember is those front two.
Yeah.
You know, and it was amazing. It was amazing to be there. But yeah, let's stop saying, oh, it's Catalunya, this will be another brilliant race.
Right. Well, not necessarily. You know, it definitely had the makings, especially in second. Jorge did an amazing job of kind of controlling the race. There was a lot of talk on between Gavin and Nick Harris about how the team communicates with Jorge using the boards and using the number 0 to signify that it's still fairly close. Even if it might be like 0.2, and then using the number 0.1 when it's like, okay, you're now starting to get clear, you know?
Yeah.
And
I'll tell you what was interesting as well, because we were positioned looking, they'd come round, we'd see them come around turn 12, come down the hill into turn 13, and looking how narrow that track is, how the hell Rossi did get past him on that 2009 race. But anyway, I digress.
I want to also mention, you know, the Bautista crash because...
just before we go there, I was just going to say about reading the boards.
Mm-hmm.
They'd come around the corner and most of them would come off the red and white banding, the rumble strip on the left, swing right across to the right, going down the straight, then come back to the left for turn one. And we were saying, why are they doing that? That's got to be a long way. And then someone went, do you think that's just so they can read their boards because the pits are on the right?
Oh, well.
And I thought, do you know what? That bloody might be. And then as soon as Lorenzo had, they were all doing it for the first few laps, then he stopped doing it and he was staying left and he'd watch Danny and Marc Marquez quite rapidly swing across to the right, hold it for 2 seconds, swing it back to the left, tuck in, and Jorge wasn't bothering.
Right.
Now, either he's very good at picking out his pit board and doesn't need to, or he just wasn't looking at it. Because he's like, I can still hear the fuckers behind me. I don't need to know how close they are because they're close.
Yep.
You know, because they never really... I mean, Danny finished 1.7 behind him. Marquez a further 0.1 behind Danny. And he was nailed to him. In fact, he nearly dobbed it, didn't he?
Yeah.
But
yeah, they almost
I got
had
ahead
touch.
Of themselves. Yeah. Some people said they did. Some people said they didn't. It was hard to tell. But I think he certainly locked the front trying to avoid...
That one moment... You know, was it the penultimate lap, I think, where
it was close to the end, wasn't it?
Yeah. Marquez decided to go for it. And I don't know how he saved it. I mean, it was pretty amazing that he finished even that close to Pedrosa because he should have been off the track. He should have been down. He should have at least been off the track, and that would have been it for the second and third race. But he somehow pulled it back. And the kid is just... Unbelievable. Yeah. I did want to go through the fact that, I mean, first of all, we had a lot of people that crashed in turn 10. And yeah. But on the first lap, when Bautista went out, and I don't know if you read what Rossi has said since then, but he's basically said that Bautista is stupid.
He said it at Mugello. Fair enough. You know, I didn't know he was there. Yeah. Oh, sorry, he didn't know I was there. We came together. This can happen. He said, but when the same guy tries to do something to the same rider in the very next race, he said, and this is the fourth time he's crashed and either taken someone out or risked taking someone out since the end of 2011.
Well, you remember he took out Rossi and a whole bunch of other riders at when he was still in the Suzuki.
Well, Pete Jones, who was with us photographing, he's got an amazing sequence of those from that crash. Yeah, with Rossi's bike. And Rossi's bike stayed upright and just kept running through without a rider on it. It's incredible. Yeah. Nicky, obviously Bautista on the Suzuki then. Yeah, there's Nicky, Rossi, one of the Pramacs, I think.
But the thing is that in that corner, when Bautista started to crash, I remember because my wife and I were watching it, wife B and I were watching it, and I saw that Rossi went deeper into the corner. I was like, man, he was so lucky to avoid that in that particular moment that he happened to go wide. But when he was talking about it afterwards, he said, I had to let off the brakes a little bit so that he wouldn't crash into me. Now I'm thinking, what kind of sixth sense do you have to have the guy behind you and know that he's going to crash into you and then let off the brakes just enough so that he misses you with the bike?
Well, let's not forget when Rossi goes around a corner, he doesn't, most of them do this thing, you know, where you look where you want to go. And Rossi famously looks almost his front wheel. So he's probably got better rearward peripheral vision than anyone else.
But also, I also think that there is a situational awareness after so many years of racing that gets developed. You know that maybe he saw it on the as they were approaching the corner that the position that the bike was that Bautista's bike was in or something that told him get out of the way.
Yeah,
you know, there's a chance he's going to go down. That was amazing. I was just like, wow, that was so close.
Definitely, I think he definitely saw him and went wide.
No, he said he had to let off the brakes, otherwise he would have gotten wiped out again, and that's why Bautista is stupid. But that corner really caught out so many people.
And I was going to just mention, as I mentioned, Pete Jones, who we've always gone with, he got some amazing pictures, and I do have to take my hat off to the entertainment provided by Yonny Hernandez. It is incredible. There's one of Pete's photos. We'll put the Flickr account list up, and you can download in lots of different sizes. You just get a very discreet little credit thing in the corners for Pete's email address. He, like yourself, Jules, he's an amateur photographer, but he humps up into Welsh Hills and photographs fast jets, and he goes to motorcycle racing, and he's just got that eye, same as you guys, and he might not quite be at the level you've got to, but often I think some of these shots, it's hard to tell the difference between those and the professional ones. I mean, some of the certainly the up and coming thrusting photographers who advertise their stuff on Twitter, I think, are asking ridiculous prices for people to buy what, you might have a mate who can take a picture that good. And none of them in touch stuff or anything. And the colors on some of these bikes, there's one of Dovi that just, it's incredible. But the one of Yonny Hernandez,
I know, I was
stepping it out.
Watching the other day.
The darkies that have been previously left by people, these black lines. He's at 45 degrees to it and his tire's on fire. It's just every lap he came around, our stand was up on their feet cheering. And I'm one of the guys said, as we'd said to Cal, or Cal had mentioned, he has been told it's not the quickest way around. And one of the guys going, well, I'm sure he'd be quicker if he didn't do that. And it was Pete Jones, I think, around him. He don't give a fuck. He's just having a laugh. and it was good. So going back to the results, we had Lorenzo stayed out front from turn one all the way. Pedrosa stayed second all the way. Marquez stayed third all the way. Rossi stayed fourth once. Unfortunately, Cal Crutchlow lost the bike, and he said himself, Covenant Garden mistake, my fault, no complaints. Bradl was fifth, and he'd just been overtaken by Nicky, who was having a brilliant race when Nicky lost it also in turn 10 quite early on. And then the one bit of excitement we had was Bradley Smith chasing down Andrea Dovizioso and finally passing him. Now, I said to Cal, you know, did Dovi have a problem? Because we didn't have access to lap times or anything. And he went, oh, God, yeah. So he had 6-inch chunks coming out of his rear tire.
Oh, Jesus, really?
Yeah, yeah. So Dovi was riding a crippled bike. But, you know, still, well done to Bradley. That's his best ever result, yep. Coming sixth. Aleth Espargaró cracking eighth and Colin Edwards ninth. And he was catching Aleth Espargaró very, very slowly. He was still 5 seconds behind at the end. Unfortunately, he ran out of time. Michele Pirro was 10th. Danilo Petrucci, 11th. Claudio Corti, 12th. The fantastic Yoni Hernandez was 13th. Brian Staring got 2 points for 14th. And Javier Del Amor, who was a wildcard rider, came in 15th. So that was great.
Yeah. It was great. And now the championship closes because we've got Lorenzo winning. So another 5 points that he takes off Pedrosa. Pedrosa leads with 123 over 116. Just a sliver, 7 points, but that's still not a first second, you know? Somebody needs to get in between for the next race.
Yeah.
Could be the guy in third, Marquez, obviously.
Yep.
Carcocciolo retains fourth position, but Rossi gets up to fifth now, past Dovizioso. He was in sixth after the last race.
Yep.
Nicky Hayden further back, Stefan Bradl, Alvaro Bautista, two races unfinished now. So he's falling like a rock.
Espargaró CRT in the top 10.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
Sorry.
No, it's great. It's just, I mean, what he's been doing with that team, what that team has been doing with that bike, it's great. It's really cool. Now, there were a lot of fallers, so the his position may seem a little artificial, but, you know, he's racing. He's out there. He's still pushing it, so.
Yeah. And I would point out, in 19th place is Yoni Hernandez with 6 points. Now, I know Ben Spies has got a satellite bike, but he's 3 points ahead of you, even though he hasn't raced for the last three races. Yoni, try and keep it a little bit straighter. In fact, no, sod it. Just keep doing what you're doing. It's fantastic. Again, this is a chance to give a shout-out to Miss Beth Andrews on Twitter, who pointed out that Marquez has won at his last three times at Assen. You guess he likes the place, so maybe he can start taking some points out of Danny.
Yeah,
which would help my boy Lorenzo. it would just be great to see, a different winner actually.
Yeah,
and Valentino Rossi again. I was there in 2009 when he got his 100th victory. He likes the place. He does well at the place. I don't know if I would say it's a Yamaha track. It probably is, but it's a strange track.
It's a strange track, but you know what it is? It's a rider's track.
Yeah, it's probably the most entertaining track that doesn't have undulation.
Yeah, you're right, because there's very, very, very little elevation changes. I think this is a track where there is no real benefit to any of the technologies used.
No.
You know, so that's, I think we may see a pretty decent race, you know. We've had a variety of winners over the years, so obviously
very quickly. Because,
well,
sorry.
Well, we should let's roll the interview with Brandon Cretu and roll the sucker out. We'll talk about testing next week.
Sure.
Okay.
Jim Reese here for Motopod with Brandon.
Hey, Jim, how's it going?
Fucking Brandon Cretu finally got him on the line. And in fact, your connection has gone to shit. Have you moved in the house?
I have not moved an inch. I swear to God.
All right. Well, good to have you on. You're home back in?
Pennsylvania. York, well, Shrewsbury, Pennsylvania.
All right. From the Isle of Man TT. And you've, I can well imagine that coming down from this is kind of a very, very, very slow process.
Yeah, I mean, every year it gets, I don't want to say it gets easier. It gets harder in some ways and easier in others. Like, I'm used to the come down of, you know, riding for 2 weeks straight. Like, I've gotten used to that more. It's just now every year it gets tougher because I'm leaving behind, like, my second set of friends and family, really. So that, I think that gets harder every year, is leaving behind like good friends that, you know, that mean a lot to me. So that's what
I would, you know, I say to somebody, actually, I think I said it to Mark, or Robert Frelini, actually, that going to races in a way is more like a family reunion if you've been to them a while. And while the racing is kick ass, it's more about just kind of meeting up with everybody.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I have some of the people I have met there, I mean, I they'll probably be lifelong friends, and I have times with them that are just, you know, some of the best times in the world. And so I really wouldn't give it up for anything.
Yep. Practice week. The weather sucked.
Yes. It sucked for everyone, and I didn't even get on the track and have dry track time until Friday, and practice was supposed to start on Monday. So, you know, it was just it was a bad situation all around, but we were all in the same boat, so it's not like we can really, none of us can really say much about it. Just, you know, when you're there, it kind of is what it is. There's nothing we can do about it. You just got to make the best of what you got.
But that being said, the TT circuit this year actually seemed pretty quick. And as things dried out, times were getting quicker and quicker. Your bike this year seemed like it was a decent bit of kit.
Yeah, it was definitely better than last year. You know, I kind of had a little bit more say in what it was going to be before I got there. With that said, you know, it was still something, it's still whenever I get there, when I ride a, you know, bike that, you know, my friend gives me to ride with Irish Bike Magazine, it's something I've never ridden before. And we usually, it's just been put together before I get there. So we have to go through, kind of feel it out, sort it out, get it set up and get it working the way that I'm comfortable with it. So with the lack of practice time, that made it really difficult because we pretty much had 2 days of practice and then go race.
Who's spinning the wrenches for you?
I had a friend actually from England, just you know, enthusiast guy. He actually used to work in motorsports with cars before he became actually a paramedic. But he's just an enthusiast.
And you should actually mention his name.
Mark Stanley.
Yeah. Okay. There you go.
Yeah, Mark Stanley, and then I also had Rob Wilson with he owns like a polishing business with his girlfriend. It's called Street Evil Polishing, but they're based out of Scotland. Him and his mate Stinky, they brought a Ford Transit with an awning along.
Nice. From
Scotland to let me work out of, and they all, you know, pitched in, helped out during the fortnight. So that, you know, without them, I definitely wouldn't have been able to do it. But yeah, we had a few hiccups along the way with just, you know, set up on the bike and make sure everything was right. And then, I mean, I didn't help anything when, with my little oopsie daisy in the beginning of the week and, with practice, I think it was, I forget what night it was. Monday night, Tuesday night.
no. Okay. This is something we did talk about. Okay. So we get to re-talk about this.
Yeah. Yeah.
This was Monday night, and
I thought it out of my mind.
I made some of this in from the talk that we had literally 2 weeks ago. You did something pretty fucking silly, dude.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Fucking stupid is more like it, or just completely asinine. But all I can say, I'll tell the story.
Actually, I want you to describe it in detail.
Basically, it was the first semi. Even that night wasn't even a dry night of practice. It was still wet in a lot of places, but it was going to be a decent enough night. So we were, obviously rushing to get the bike up there and get it through scrutineering. And anyone that's been to TT knows, like, scrutineering there is definitely more stringent than anywhere else, and you'll wait in line for an hour because there's so many bikes, you know, queuing up. Well, we got through scrutineering, but when we went through there, they stopped us for having some stuff wired that wasn't normally, like, we never had to wire it in years past, and I didn't know about it, like exhaust hanger springs and like this weird stuff. So it wound up holding us up for longer than we expected. So we wound up getting held up for the bike didn't get out of scrutineering and get approved until practice was already like 5 minutes underway. So by then we didn't have time to get on warmers. We didn't have time for anything. So I pretty much was in my leathers right when they the scrutineer signed off on it, and they took off the stand. I hopped on the bike. And
So you go all the way down to the end of the pits and come all the way back up.
They weren't even letting us up down to the end of the pits yet. They were actually putting us out on that little slip road right by the pit lane entrance.
Yep.
So I went up on that on the slip road. Yeah, they weighed me up. I go up there right away because I was the only one queuing up because everyone was already out on track.
Yeah.
I go up, and when I pulled up on the Glen Cutcher Road, like, you have to stay in a blend line.
Right.
I went off of it a little bit, so I kind of was, like, leaning over a little bit as I got on the gas to get going. And, I mean, I swear to God, I wasn't even on the gas hard. I mean, the rear tire was cold, and I just got on the gas a tiny bit, and the thing literally, like, snapped. And the rear tire stepped out completely and fucking threw me down. I wasn't even 10 meters past the damn start line. And it was probably the most embarrassing, like, incident ever in my racing career by far.
This is a golf clap from here, Brandon.
Yeah, right. So I had this massive high side, 10 meters from the start line. And I had to get up over top of the barrier and walk past everyone to just watch me wreck. So it was like a walk of shame past all these spectators that were looking at me like, did this really just happen?
and it actually caused them to have to stop practice, which was even worse.
No, they didn't stop.
Well, they weren't letting anybody else out because they were trying to clean up your shit.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But they, I mean, literally, I think they got my bike moved off within like less than a minute. There was already a marshal. I mean, obviously the marshal's already there, so they just ran out, picked the bike up, and rolled it off. So I walked off in my shame and disappointment. But, you know, I always look at the story. Number one, I'm one of the people, like, I can laugh. Like, it's whatever. I can laugh at myself. You know, it was funny. Everyone got 2 weeks of laughter out of it because I didn't hear the end of it for 2 fucking weeks.
Well, you may not hear the end of it for a long
forever.
Time.
I think forever is a good word. So, but, I mean, I'll say this, it did put a small silver lining in the day because, I mean, that's the same day that Yoshinori Matsushita lost his life, over at Balakrai. So, and, you know, it gave someone, just gave everyone something to smile about on that day because it definitely was a sad day in the paddock. That happened after my incident. So, you know, while everyone was feeling down, they weren't feeling down enough to not make fun of me as I walked by. So at least I made something good out of it.
that is a excellent cap on what was a down day.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. so let's talk as the week went on because we can kind of work our way through this. You did kind of find your mojo as the week went on. Things went much better. As you guys got your kit back together. And I think that, frankly, you had a fairly successful TT Fortnite.
Yeah, you know, whenever I go there, my main goal is to have fun. You know, it's not the kind of place you want to be riding if you're not having fun and you're not really enjoying it and, you know, living it up. Now, granted, I did have, you know, some certain goals that I wanted to, you know, I was shooting for this year. Another goal was just to go faster and just improve every time I went out, which I definitely did. I never did wind up getting to my 120-mile-an-hour goal, but compared to last year, definitely a success, definitely an improvement. You know, I finished my, you know, Sunday was the Superbike race. I finished that and did solid 117s the whole time, 6 laps. I mean, that's 2 hours of riding around there, which is pretty intense mentally and physically. And, you know, I finished it and I felt good afterwards. Like, I wasn't completely gassed. Now my knees had a different story. My knees were about to explode off the bike.
I bet.
Just because, I mean, I have bad knees as it is, so they were like shot when I got off the bike. But, you know, otherwise I felt really good. So that, I was really happy with that, with my fitness going into it. I was happy that, you know, I was running the times I was. And then, you know, I kept getting, every time I went out, I got faster. So that's a good sign. And I never, like I said, you know, with lack of practice time, and everyone suffered from this. We just really struggled to get the bike how I wanted it, and I was struggling with stability the whole time I was there riding. Like, the bike never felt confident in that it wasn't going to try to spit me off. You know, in terms of the front end, like I felt like I always feel a chassis loading up, like in certain areas, like it wanted to just go in like this vicious tank slap.
Yep.
So that was a struggle, and that's, it really slowed me down in some areas just because I was kind of nursing it, just like, I'll take it easy, 'cause I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if this bike's going to unleash and throw me off or do what. So, that kind of culminated in, you know, into a massive moment in the Superstock race on Monday. You know, I did a 1:17.6 from a standing start, 1:17.8 when I pulled into the pit. So I hadn't even had a flying lap, and I'm already like running 1:18 lap times if I had a flying lap, 1:18, 1:19. So then on the third lap, I went down the bottom of Bagaro, where you bottom, you know, the whole bike bottoms out. Yeah. You're really
a grind.
Yeah, I mean, just like banging at the bottom of that hill. And every time I went through there earlier in the week, it was always getting like, I always get this little bit of tank stuff, but nothing like insane. Well, this time, I mean, it just let loose. And I rode this insane tank slap from like there all the way to almost the braking marker for the 13th.
Mm.
And I saw people were watching like a little side road. And I saw it on a Cormana as I was like holding on for dear life.
When you see spectators' eyes go wide,
Their eyes just go wide. They backed up about 10 feet. I saw them back up. Like they actually stood back. I was like, they had to been thinking this guy's done. And I was thinking in my head, I'm done. Like I was kind of planning what was going to happen. Like, should I jump off? Should I try to lay the bike down? And then eventually I was like,
should I wave on the way past?
Yeah. I was like, fuck it. I'll just hold on. And somehow it corrected itself. And then I came through the 13th, and then there's one part where it kind of falls away, and then you dip left and then you head into Kirkmichael. I got a little bit of tank stop there again. And then on the way into Kirkmichael, I got another one. And I was like, all right, something's wrong. I pulled off and the steering damper had blown a seal. And I think it was from just that violent one I had at the bottom of the Garrow. It just couldn't handle it.
You and steering dampers, you're not very good at the aisle.
Yeah. The TT in 2011, it actually wasn't even the steering damper that went bad. It was the head bearings. Huh. That caused the steering damper bolts to actually come out.
Well, whatever.
Yeah, it was just, it was just an unfortunate series of events. And then, after that, you know, we thought we had it fixed, and I went out in the Wednesday night practice for the senior, and it wasn't. I had to pull off at Crosby Pub, and then I went out again.
Oh, yeah, for you.
I always tell myself, I'm going to stop the TT course, I'm going to stop somewhere that I at least have people to talk to, and if I want to get a pint, I can.
Thank you.
So I pulled off there, and then the same thing during the senior. Obviously the senior started, and then they red flagged it because of that big incident at Bray Hill, which I never really found much other about other than the dude somehow miraculously survived. And, you know, no one was killed, thank God. But I actually got red flagged, and I pulled over again at Crosby Pub and talked to the same people that were there on Wednesday night.
did you buy them a pint this time?
No, I didn't drink a pint at all when I went there the first time or the second time. Now, when I went there after the if they would have red flagged the senior and they would have told us, like, yeah, this race isn't going to happen today, then I probably would have started drinking. But I knew they were going to, like, restart it, so I just hung out there and talked to them until they had us go back around. So then at the restart,
Isn't it weird going cross course?
We actually went the whole way around the course.
Oh, they had you. They had you go all the way.
Yeah, so really? Then we got to do like a parade lap around the course, which was probably the most relaxing ride around the TT course I've ever had. Because then you're just kind of cruising around and not having to worry about going fast. You can wave and do some wheelies and do whatever else you want to do.
Okay.
So yeah, it then, you know, after the first lap, at the end, right at Governor's Dip, I went on that tight.
I'm going to warn you right now. You're doing a Mark Miller. You're making a ton of noise.
Okay. Is it still making a lot of noise?
Yeah. Still making a lot of noise.
Oh, it's my landline.
I'm going to leave this in. Because I don't edit anything.
Okay.
Right. Okay.
So then. Right. I come around the first lap at the end of lap one at Governor's Dip, right when you come down the nook, then you have that tight right-hander, first gear.
Yep.
Come around there, and I dip in, and it felt like when I went to the stops to, like, get it to turn, it felt like the steering almost locked up, and then I literally felt like I was falling. Like, it felt like the bike was falling over. and I had to like throw it back up to get it to stand up, and I leaned it again. It felt like it was doing the same thing, so I pulled in after the first lap in the pits, and we looked at it. Well, number one, like one of the air ducts was hanging out, and I saw that, and it looked like the steering arm was actually like kind of getting caught in it. So I didn't know what was wrong, what was causing the feeling of like it was just felt like it was going to fall over, and I'm like, all right, I'm like, it was the last race, I'm like, I'm done, I'm not, you know, I don't want to ride this anymore. Yeah, so I called it a day at that. You know, it's not the place you want to ride if you're not comfortable with what you're on. And at that point, I wasn't comfortable.
I remember doing an endurance race, and halfway through the fourth lap, the fairing came dislodged on the right side, and it actually started at high speed wedging up against the handlebar. And trying to steer in at high speed, it was pushing back against it, and I was like, "This is probably not safe."
Yeah, right.
you're like, "This is not a good sign." All right, well, so done, finished. Your finishing position.
My best finishing position was in the. Well, obviously, I finished the Super Stock or the Senior. So I finished in 37th in the Superbike, but I started 52nd. So I finished better than where I started. So that was, I mean, obviously a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my best finish. My best finishing position, I think, was 32nd or 31st in the Super Sport in 2011. So I finished better then, but I mean, obviously it was a six lap race. It's a totally different ball game.
You finished.
Yeah, exactly. last year I didn't have a single finish to my name last year, and I, you know, crashed on the fourth lap. And I mean, honestly, last year I was like, on the fourth lap, I was exhausted. I wasn't physically ready for riding a 1,000 around there. So I would say this year, leaps and bounds was a success in a lot of ways. You know, I can't really, I mean, I get to go there, I get to race, you know, I have some great sponsors behind me, and, you know, I get a lot of good support, so I can't really say it's not a success. You know, I have a good time doing it, and I, you know, I'm lucky enough to do it, so.
So, let's take a step forward. Sponsors, and after that, we'll talk about the post-TT festivities.
Okay.
Dive in.
Yeah, I mean, this year, well, we're doing the my main title sponsor is Motul, and we're doing basically a video, not, I don't want to say a series, but we're doing a series of videos from the TT and Macau this year. So I have Joel Hopper, who he owns a recording studio down in Atlanta. He's been in the industry in music and advertising for a long time. I hooked up with him through Huey at Marriott Motorsports, and he went along. Did video. We're actually in the process of editing that right now and getting the final cut together. So that'll be out probably within the next week or two. It just kind of like highlights, kind of like a little video, just highlights my experience with the TT and has some cool.
I look forward to it.
Yeah, it's got some really cool stuff. We worked with North One on it too, so they gave me like on track footage. So it's gonna be really cool.
You know, in a way, you kind of broke through the onboard glass ceiling, because you remember you and I were campaigning, what, 2 years ago? Really hard to get GoPro out there. And then last year, working even harder. And this year, they actually kind of let people go, okay, go, you know, promote it through onboard.
Yeah, no, it depended. They had quite a few people. They put them on a few bikes this year. I think it was mainly what they were bringing to the table. But yeah, North One is really, they're really willing to work with me. I think it's also because Motul is a big title sponsor of the TT.
Yeah.
So they were really great. And I've made some good friends within the organization now. So, you know, hopefully as years pass, it'll become easier to get, you know, to get that kind of stuff, to make promotional videos for sponsors and for racers, because then it helps us get sponsors. It helps them promote the TT. It's good all around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just have to make sure you do it in a way where, you know, North One's still getting credit and the TT still getting credit for the footage that they're getting.
Yep.
So, I mean, yeah, mainly it was, Motul was a huge help this year. And obviously Dunlop, I can't thank them enough. They stepped up the game and they've supported me.
How many tires did you run through?
Actually not that many. We, because of the limited practice and everything, I think I used like five rears and.
What tires were you running specifically? Technically.
We were supposed to run the US stuff and we didn't. Then we wound up running the UK, the treaded tire, like the DOT version of their. I'm not too familiar with the UK stuff because I always run the US stuff. That's what I ran in my car as well. Yep. We just had a little logistical issue. But we wound up running the UK stuff. So Dunlop USA and Dunlop UK were really good to me there and working out a deal. They were great. Like I said, I'm normally used to running the US slicks. That's what I'm, be running at my Cal again this year. So yeah, Dunlop has been awesome to me. I can't thank them enough. And, then Sport Bike Track here hooked me up with all my gear and Irish Bike Magazine with the bike. So it's, I got a lot of good people helping me out. And, obviously all the other people that have been with me for years, Help Performance and everyone else. I mean, they're always behind me. So.
And of course the knucklehead at Motopod.
Yes, I think his name's Jim Race.
I try and help you out best as I can, my friend. I can't fold this up. I cannot fold this up. The end game. What happens? you know what happens. Colors. Did you go there?
I actually did not. We did not make it to Colors at all. I went there one night this year. I think it was on Wednesday after the, It was either Monday night after Super Stock Race or Wednesday after the senior practice, because then we have like a day off on those days. The next
bad
day.
Bad things happen.
Yeah, but probably the best night was Friday night. We went to the courthouse. I don't know if you've ever been there.
Oh yes, yeah. The courthouse was actually very busy this year.
Yeah, I prefer the courthouse. Fucking blows. It's so gross there.
Yeah.
But the courthouse is actually a lot of fun, and that's where everyone seems like they go nowadays. We went there, and I was with. I mean, everyone was there. I mean, I was with obviously my guys helped me out, and then Gary Johnson and the Quattro Plant team. And anytime I hang out with Gary Johnson,
trouble.
Completely the worst fucking influence I've ever met. That's for sure. But we hung out that night. We wound up going downstairs. So they have like a disco dance club downstairs that's open much later than the upstairs part of the courthouse. We stayed there, and then I wound up. At a chips and cheese place or chips and whatever place that like
chips, cheese and gravy.
Yeah. And that I wound up eating chips, cheese, gravy with chicken nuggets in it at like 5 a.m. So that was like awful the next day. And then actually Saturday again with Gary being the worst influence, we were supposed to, I went down to Castletown with, him, his girlfriend and, two of his mates. And we were supposed to go watch the post TT races.
Yep.
We never really got that far. We stopped at a pub and sat outside in the sun and drank beer all day long. And he literally passed out on the way home in his car. And I took a picture of it and posted it on his Facebook.
well done, Gary.
So yeah, I took a picture of him and posted it on his Facebook. That was very humorous. So we never actually got to. I never got to see those races. I really did really want to see them, and then we wound up sitting there and just talking about nothing the whole day. So that was pretty.
No, dude, it's not talking about nothing. It's talking about real life.
Yeah.
And when you're hanging out at the TT,
you've obviously never talked to Gary Johnson. When you talk to him, it's literally like talking about nothing.
Actually, your point might be well made. all right. And so speaking of talking about nothing, I believe that is a perfect point to wrap it up. Wow. That was cool.
I'm getting a little better at this. I'm not.
You are.
Just a personality. I need to get rid of that nickname.
You were kind of shitty about that at the beginning. You're getting much better. All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, Brendan Cretu. Raced the TT this year, raced Macau last year, has done 1, 2, 3 TTs, four TTs, done 3 Macaus.
This will be, this year will be my second Macau.
Okay.
I've been there for years. I've been there 2 years, but this is my second year racing, my third year.
Knucklehead from Philadelphia, somebody that I consider a good friend and somebody that deserves a bit of attention and always, always fucking tries hard. So, Brandon, tip of the hat to you from the Motopod Squadron. Well done. You keep on doing what you're doing, man.
All right. Thanks, man. I appreciate having you on again.
Absolutely.
So thanks ever so much to Jim and Brendan for that rerun one. I just very, very quickly have to point out that I've dropped 6 points in the MCN Fantasy League to 12th. Jim's dropped 16 to 31st, and Jules has dropped 24 points to 141st. Yabu sucks. You were trying to spin this out, so we didn't have time for that. So I thought I'd stick it in. And we have been tests at Catalina Aragon. We will run the details of those next week when there'll be no racing to talk about, and hopefully we'll have a little bit more time.
Right, and more info.
And World Superbike and World Supersports will be at Imola a week Sunday. Don't forget, fans, that the MotoGP race at Assen is on Saturday, in keeping with their tradition.
Right.
It's been wonderful. There will be a link in the show notes to Pete Jones's Flickr page for the pictures. I do suggest you go and have a look. They are great.
All right, Martin, it was great talking to you, and I'm sorry I have to kind of run, but real life beckons.
Unfortunately, it does for all of us. I need to go get my head down.
All right, buddy.
Cheers, everybody. Cheers, Jules.
Ciao.
Good night.
Good night. I hate having to do that. I hate having to cut it, but I gotta go, dude.
No, absolutely understand. Right, I'll get this uploading, and I will speak to you soon.
Thanks, buddy. See you. Have a good night.
Bye.